You're listening to Beyond Bourbon Street, an insider's guide to New Orleans. Beyond Bourbon Street is the podcast where we explore the food, music, culture, places, and people that make New Orleans unique. Whether you are planning a trip, living in New Orleans, or simply wanting a taste of the Crescent City from wherever you are, you've come to the right place. And now, your host, Mark Bologna.
Hey y'all, this is Mark. Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to episode 23. I hope you enjoyed the last show where I interviewed Sally Asher, author of The St. Louis Cemeteries of New Orleans. We discussed the history and burial traditions of the Crescent City, and Sally also shared the stories of some of the people buried in the three St. Louis cemeteries here in the city. It's already becoming one of our most downloaded shows, so if you missed it, go back and give it a listen. Before we get into today's topic, I want to say thanks to those of you who left me a review on iTunes. We're up to 91 reviews now. Thanks to Aquastic, to NH Rich, to the Milan Man, and thanks to Jezbomb, who writes, "Thanks, Mark, for putting together such an informative, entertaining, and well-presented podcast. I'm from South Wales in the UK and have been a loyal New Orleans Saints fan for around 15 years. What I love most about your podcast is the unique insight and perspective of the city. It's easy to tell just how much the city of New Orleans means to you and the people that live there. It's interesting, informative, and an absolute joy to listen to." Thanks, Richard. Now, on to the show. Today, I interview a local musician, songwriter Paul Sanchez. I was excited to interview Paul because I've been a fan for years, and I know what a great storyteller he is. He also has a love for the people and culture of New Orleans that matches my own. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the discussion. All right, my guest today is a writer, a musician, an actor, but that only scratches the surface. He has 14 albums of his own, another 11 as a member of the rock band Cowboy Mouth, plus numerous other recordings, collaborations, and projects. He co-wrote, recorded, and performed, along with a cast of others, a musical adaptation of the Dan Baum book, Nine Lives. He also played himself in the HBO series Tremé. Mostly, though, when I think of my guest, I think of the words New Orleanian. Welcome to the show, Mr. Paul Sanchez.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Mark.
Thanks for doing this, Paul.
My pleasure. Good to see you. Good to chat with you again.
You know, I know your story, but for our listeners, I'd like to talk about growing up. You grew up in the Irish Channel, right?
I did. I was born at Saramayo Hospital, a couple of blocks from the Mississippi River, and grew up in the Channel, in the neighborhood of German, Italian, Irish, longshoreman, as my daddy was.
And you were in a big family, right? You had 10, 11 siblings?
Yeah, I had five brothers and five sisters. Wasn't the biggest in the neighborhood. The Dominguez family had 15 kids, and the Abadi family had 22 kids from the same parents. So we were just a small one, you know, with 11.
And I think it's interesting. We did a show about the history of the Irish in New Orleans. And the Irish Channel is a little bit of a misnomer because back by then, like you said, it was really pretty multicultural.
It really was, yeah. But largely Irish still, I would say. My uncle, Richard Burke, Dick Burke, was the assessor of the Channel for 40 years, and his influence is still felt in the celebrations throughout those neighborhoods, and a lot of the Irish traditions and the Irish culture stem from his commitment to making sure they stayed so. He was a good man, a great man, I'd say.
What was it like growing up in the neighborhood with all those kids?
Well, you know, it was fun. There were always kids in the street. We were poor. But you got two things when you're poor. You got music. So the radio's always on and somebody is always singing. You know, and I had older brothers and sisters, so I got a real musical education as they all flipped the channel on each other. And the other thing that was free back then was to play ball in the street, you know. Somebody always had something you could throw around, and you played street ball. Life's more complicated now with video games and hi-fi, you know, the systems have gotten more complicated. But it seemed simple, you know. I could sing and I could go run outside. I guess that's what I still do.
Was music very much a part of the household back then?
It really was. You know, my mother liked to whistle and sing while she worked. And like I say, my older siblings, when you're back then in America, especially when you're a poor family, the radio's always on. The music's free. It's one of the few things in life that's free back then. And so I remember seeing my sister Sandy had a poster of Hank Williams and, you know, maybe... I remember the first Beatles album I ever stole from one of my sisters was with the Beatles, and the black and white one with their four faces, and each of their faces had a lipstick print on the thing. I don't know which of my sisters did it, but I had that until the flood, actually. So yeah, the music was always in the house. I had a couple of older brothers that played horn, and a younger brother that played horn, and my oldest brother was an actor, and he did some musical theater, but he also directed the DC Pops back in the 60s when they used to do those things with orchestras doing pop songs and stuff. So he was always bringing back fantastic tales to New Orleans of having met, like, he worked with George Martin back in the 60s on one of those things, which blew my mind as a little kid, you know, and all those things drew me to music. You know, I was compelled to sing and write. My first song was when I was six. I wrote.
Wow.
You know.
And I remember some of your early work. You have a song that talks about your mom singing, I think, as I recall. Or I certainly remember you telling that story at some of your live shows.
Yeah, yeah. She was. She was. She loved music. She wasn't a professional or anything. She just loved it. You know, I guess it was much like it is for me. It was her release of pain and her escape from daily life, as well as an expression of joy.
When did you join your first band? Was it the Backbeats or was it before that?
No, before the Backbeats. I had a band in college with a couple of guys that wound up in the Backbeats. Well, John Herbert. It was called Godot, which I was reading a Samuel Beckett play, and so I named the band Godot, and it was just a terrible idea because in New Orleans, you know, you didn't find a lot of existentialist rock fans back in the early 70s, and so Godot, we got called, and Go Do It, and Got It. We rarely got called Godot, so we had to change the name eventually to the Backbeats.
And so the Backbeats, and again, that kind of carries forward a theme because, as we'll get to in a minute, you later started another band and also found inspiration in a play, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the Backbeats was, again, John Herbert, but Vance DeGeneres, who had been in the Cold and was a really big deal in New Orleans still, and we were glad to have him, and Steve Walters, who had been in the Normals and gave us some legitimacy with those two guys, you know, having had successful bands, and then Fred and Herbert and I could pretend that we were successful through having known Vance and Steve Walters. And so that was fun, and that sort of led to the Cowboy Mouth thing. I was by then working on movies. I'd stumbled into working on the movie Miller's Crossing, the Coen Brothers movie. They were shooting in New Orleans back in 89, long before Hollywood South, and really liked that life. They're all sort of gypsies and circus carnies, you know. They travel from job to job, and sure, it's a lot of fun. It's pretty exciting to light up a street at night and make magic happen. Even if you're only carrying cable and bringing coffee, you're still there, and it's fun. I was a kid and wound up living and working in Boston, and I was on a television show up there called Against the Law. It was the first show Fox ever aired. Really? I think it lasted like 3.5 episodes. It went dark in the middle of the fourth episode, and they said, sorry, we'll try again, you know. But Fred called, and he had a record deal with Capitol Records, Fred LeBlanc. He said, would you want to come play on my record? So I quit my job and flew to where we were going to do it in Wisconsin, and his A&R guy flew in the next day and said, Fred, I got fired, and you got dropped, sorry, so you don't have a record deal, you know. And he was like, well, I could book us gigs and we could form a band. So we formed Cowboy Mouth. And we couldn't agree on a name at first. He wanted to call us after some replacement song, Here Come the Regulars. And I just thought that sounded so regular, you know. And I wasn't a replacements fan. And we kind of argued about names for a while, but I came up with Cowboy Mouth. And like he said later, it was the only name he didn't hate. He didn't really quite endorse it, but he didn't hate it. And Griff was always affable. He, you know, whatever anybody wanted was fine. I'm sure it still is with Griff. He's the easiest going guy in the world. So it was Cowboy Mouth. Yeah, my second play name that then people started saying, huh? Cowboy Cloth? What? Cotton Mouth? What is that?
Well, before we jump that, I want to jump back for a moment to the Backbeats. And how is it that you guys ended up doing a video with Steven Soderbergh?
Vance was friends with someone who knew him. Steven's father was a teacher at LSU. He wasn't in class there, but his father was teaching there. And Steven later told me he was working the change booth at the video arcade where I used to hang out and play pinball before Backbeat shows. And so Vance brought him around, and he shot this very clever video that you can see on YouTube in black and white with us holding light bulbs as microphones. And we looked very new wave in our little new wavy costumes. And at the end of it, he said, you know, you guys owe me $5,000 for the video. And by then we had broken up. So we were like, well, we don't have $5,000 and we don't really need the video. And he said, said, well, I can't give you the video unless I get paid. And we said, well, we really can't use it. And he kept it. And it was on his demo reel when he got the financing to make Sex, Lies, and Videotape. So we were that close. Later on, he made a movie called The Underneath, and he used cowboy mouth in the movie. And the movie didn't do very well. And when his next film came out, he did an interview in The Gambit and said, I kind of had a feeling when I was making The Underneath that it was going to be a flop. And I emailed him and said, next time you kind of have a feeling you're going to make a hit, would you use me in that one? He hasn't called yet, but I know he's just waiting for that feeling. Oh, yeah, he's just waiting for that feeling.
It's coming. I'll put a link in the show notes over on the webpage at beyondbourbonst.com to the video you're talking about on YouTube. So Jet Black and Jealous came out in 1992. You guys had already started Cowboy Mouth by then, right?
We'd already started Cowboy Mouth, but we hadn't put out a record yet. Cowboy Mouth was playing in Atlanta, a little Five Points, and we were opening for the locally popular band in Atlanta at the time that sounded like the Chili Peppers, but were different, because everywhere in America, everybody sounded like the Chili Peppers, but different in 92. And this woman came up to me after the show, and I'd had one too many Jim Beams, and she said, what's wrong with you? You look like you're in a bad mood. I said, I don't really like the band I'm in. I don't like the band that's on stage at all. I'm a really good songwriter. Nobody cares. And she handed me her card and said, well, I care. And I sent it to her, and she said, yeah, I like this. I want to put it out. And I said, well, great. I'll go into the studio. And she said, no, I want to put this out. And I said, well, this was put out. This was recorded on a 4-track Tascam cassette recorder. It's on the cassette. And she said, well, I don't know how you recorded it, but I love the way this guy sounds. He sounds like he doesn't think anybody's ever going to listen to him, and that's what I want. So I want to put this out. So I brought it to a studio, and my friend Richard Byrd, who's an engineer in New Orleans, did the best job he could to take the tape hiss out, and we put out Jet Black and Jealous.
That's amazing. I didn't know that story. And so that was written largely when you were still living in New York or Boston?
I started writing almost all those songs when I was living in New York back in the late 80s. I was going up there to try and be the next Bruce Dylan or Bob Springsteen. And wound up meeting a bunch of great songwriters. You know, my friend Roger Manning, who still teaches me about songwriting, and just a lot of great players in this Lower East Side scene. And actually recorded those songs at Roger Manning's apartment on Broom Street, a little tiny one-room place that he called the Broom Closet. And it was his Tascam cassette recorder, actually. So yeah, most of the songs were written in New York between 87 and 89. When I moved home, and I'm pretty sure the record came from a demo tape I made at Roger's place in 89, just before I moved back to New Orleans.
And the album really tells a story about your life, and you're in your mid-20s probably back then, and going through finding yourself in a relationship. And
well, you know, I don't consider myself a novelist. I consider myself a journalist, and my songs are all just one long song that I started writing when I was young, and I'll stop writing when I lay down. So yeah, it's telling the story of who I was at the time, which was a guy who was going through a relationship that was ending, and it was trying to find out what it meant to have something lasting, and trying to find out what tomorrow was going to bring, and hopefully not use too much scotch to get there. But he was young and foolish and didn't know any better.
And I should mention here, while we're talking, you can find Paul at paulsanchez.com. You can find him on Facebook. You can also find him on Instagram at Paul Sanchez Music. But you can certainly go through the catalog at paulsanchez.com, and we'll talk about what you're doing these days a little later on, and Facebook's probably a great place to see that. But when I first heard Jet Black and Jealous, again, you're a songwriter, you're a storyteller, you're a New Orleanian, you've won several awards as Songwriter of the Year in New Orleans, and as I listened to Jet Black and Jealous, and then recently Heart Renovations, you know, we were talking before we turned on the recorder, 2 decades, and in many ways it's the same stories, but it's sort of a lifelong story, right, and a thread of what's happening to a young man in his 20s and now a man a little bit older.
I think that the young man responded with desperation, and the older man has responded to a similar situation with resignation. Hmm. And both songs, or both CDs, carry bits of old New Orleans, you know, and tell you a story. On Jet Black and Jealous, it talks about my mom and dad walking to the boat to save a nickel so they could have a Coke when they got on the boat. And then in Heart Renovations, I'm talking about Lucille, who was my mama, and, you know, had those great old school New Orleans lessons, like never go to bed angry, baby, and always wake up saying I love you. You know, and I can still hear her voice telling me that, even though she's been gone now for almost 10 years.
You know, and I, again, we were talking, I'm just a little bit younger than you, and I grew up with Jet Black and Jealous and kind of going through a difficult time back then, and it sort of was an anthem, you know, a little bit. And I think that's one of the beautiful things about your stories is they're relatable because they're life, right? They're what people go through. And
well, I try in my songs to be as honest as I can, because I always figure whether it's joyful or whether it's sad or even whether it's lost, somebody out there is in that moment, and hearing the song makes them feel less alone in the universe, you know, to know that, oh, somebody else felt like that. That's great.
And I would say, you know, having been a fan back then, it was an opportunity to see whether it was Cowboy Mouth or See You Alone or see you and Fred playing acoustic on a Christmas night at Tipitina's. You know, so much of it was about telling stories and shared community. You know, there'd be a lot of people there singing together and having a few drinks too many and just kind of relating about life in New Orleans back then.
It's still the shows I try to take around the country. I try to create moments of shared community. That's really well put. Thank you.
You know, and so you mentioned that. So you guys were on the road with Cowboy Mouth for 15, 16 years, right?
14 years, really. 14. It felt like much longer.
And you guys toured hard, 250,
oh,
300
yeah,
shows a year.
It's not the years, it's the miles.
And you guys put a lot of miles on.
Indeed.
You know, I was flipping back over the last week. I still think, and you posted it recently on Facebook, that live album, Mouth and Off, right? Live uh-huh. and More. Was that the one recorded in France?
It was recorded in Paris, yeah, I believe. Was that in Paris at the New Morning? No, that was in a club in Rennes. Yeah, but yeah, it was in France, and it was released on a French record label, Verve. They released, I think, two of them over there, and we toured France 6 times.
Wow.
Which was, you know, big fun.
And I think that Cowboy Mouth shows were always sort of an aerobic experience, you know, a religious experience in a little bit.
You can actually look up the French television appearance from 1993 on YouTube, and we were very much into the aerobic phase of our yes. shows back then, you know.
I yeah. remember lots of hopping and jumping up and down.
Lots of running and jumping and leaping, and much like a Baryshnikov ballet, but without the grace.
Yeah, you guys are great in a lot of things, but grace probably wasn't one of them.
No.
But I think that album, if anybody were going to go back and listen to Cowboy Mouth, seeing a show live was the way to see Cowboy Mouth, but that live album was a pretty good way to capture it.
It was fun. The energy's on that album. Sonically, it's a little thin. You know, we never really captured the energy and the oomph at the same time on a record.
Yeah, I think Cowboy Mouth was best served live.
Best served live is well put. It was good times back then, you know. Griff and Steve and Fred and I wouldn't even have a set. You know, we would get on stage and I would just start a song and the band would follow, and wherever I felt like going, whatever energy I thought the crowd was giving us, we used to crowd it, you know, call it energy surfing, and they trusted me to make it up as I went along, and it made for some frenzied nights.
It sure did. It was because no two shows were ever the same, and you could feel it. You guys would feed off each other. You'd feed off the crowd. I remember even back then people shouting out, you know, play this, play that,
mm-hmm.
The craziness. But it strikes me that one of the things that and I know obviously there were some ups and downs there, and then Katrina hit, but one of the threads that, as I listened to your music, both Cowboy Mouth and Solo, is even back then, there was the songwriting, the storytelling, but there was also the friendships and the collaborations.
Mm-hmm.
Even in Heart Renovations, right? The first track on that, you talk about some of the friends that clearly you met there. Mm-hmm. You talk about Griff, and you talk about Sonia Tetlow and Mary Lesang and Rob. So it seems to me that your storytelling was also always about building relationships.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. I think that I am always looking for connection beyond the surface moment offers. And so in a show, I'm not just looking to entertain people. I'm looking for some sense of connection so that everybody walked away feeling like we were friends for a night.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Definitely. So you were in the band that long and then Katrina hit.
And things just changed. You know, I was the only person in the band who lost everything. And so I was lost, and they did their best to work around me. And, they took some time off for me. But in the long run, life needed to just be a do-over in more ways than I knew at the time, and I didn't really commit to anything. I spent the 10 years after Katrina working in fits and starts. Nine Lives was a wonderful experience, but it was not a full-time experience. And I wouldn't commit to playing on the road full-time because I was trying to build a home life. And the movie industry offered me some work, but not enough. So everything seemed to be treading floodwater that only I could see. And only in the last year or so have I gotten back to playing music full-time and going around the country full-time. And that seems what I'm supposed to be doing.
And we're very happy for that. So I do want to go back to Katrina, though. How did Nine Lives? So Nine Lives, you're talking about the Dan Baum book, and then you and Coleman Decay, right?
Coleman, I had met after the flood. He's a guy from L.A. He's a writer, and he and I wrote a song called "Exit to Mystery Street" because he wanted to try a songwriting. He'd never done it, and he got excited by the concept and had read this New York Times bestseller called Nine Lives about New Orleans. And at the time I was sort of burned out on things about the flood, people writing about the flood. And he explained to me it wasn't about the flood, it was about what happened between Hurricane Betsy and Katrina. So life is what happens between the storms, you know. And once I got that, and the first character that sort of grabbed my attention was Joanne. At first I turned him down, he was staying at my place. Then in the middle of the night I went and woke him up and said, I got a song written, it's about that wild character Joanne. And then he was up and we were off and running, and I'd come up with a tune and a thread of a story, and he's a great word man, and we'd throw words at each other until we agreed that this was a song. And we did that for 39 songs. Chris Joseph, the head honcho of Threadhead Records, organized an effort to get us a Pepsi grant, and every Threadhead in the world, from Sherwood Forest Drive in New Orleans to Australia down under, did their level best to get people to get Pepsi to give us that grant, and they did. I spent a year and a half in a recording studio with 135 New Orleans musicians, all of whom I love dearly in my heart to this day, for giving me their little piece of New Orleans. And it was the project of a lifetime. It told the story of New Orleans from the time I was a little boy of 5 years old till the time I was a grown man of 46, having to deal with yet a new beginning.
And it captures not only your life, but as you mentioned, the lives.
I got to tell
many.
My life through the eyes of the nine, as they're called. You know, Joanne Guidos, who owns Cajun's Pub, Dr. Frank Minyard, who was our coroner for 40 years, Billy Grace, who was a pillar of the uptown community and stayed to try and help rebuild New Orleans. You know, Wilbert Rawlins Jr., a band leader, a high school band leader, which in New Orleans, high school bands like being a rock star. And 60 Minutes even covered him last year as one of the finest band leaders in the country. And of course, the legendary Ronald Lewis down at the House of Dancing Feathers, who is a master of keeping culture alive in this town.
He is. I got to spend a little time with Ronald. We did an episode on the history, or not really history, but on the Mardi Gras Indians. And I got to go see Mr. Francis over at the Backstreet Cultural Museum, not far from here. And I got to go hang out with Ronald.
Sweet.
Yeah, good man. And by the way, if you ever visit New Orleans, or if you're from New Orleans, you've never taken the time to go to those two places, you need to go see Mr. Francis over at the Cultural Museum. And also go see Ronald out in the Ninth Ward.
At the House of Dancing Feathers.
The House of Dancing Feathers. He's got just such a great... The thing that strikes me about him is you maybe go there with one idea, and you leave... And this guy is such an ambassador across cultures.
Indeed.
You know, and so willing to share not only his culture, and he grew up in the Mardi Gras Indian traditions, but he talks about the Cajun traditions and the Jewish traditions. And you walk away feeling like, what just happened to me, man?
But, right.
He has a way, much like your songs do, much like your collaborations that I want to get into. That's been one of the neatest things for me about doing this. I went down to see Ronald. In fact, I think I sent you a message saying, could you help me?
Yeah.
And I walked away with a new friend and
nice.
A new appreciation.
Nice. You know?
And that's kind of what we try to bring to people here. So clearly, Nine Lives brought so many people together. And what I loved about it, besides the story and the music, was that you did what we talked about, what feels to me you've made a life out of, and that's bringing people together. And when you get the chance to have a little bit of spotlight, find a way to share it with so many other people. I think you said 130, 135 musicians took part in that. Tell us a little bit about Threadhead. How did Threadhead come to be, and what is it?
Threadheads met on the Jazz Fest chat forum prior to the flood. They were just people from around the world who loved New Orleans music. They didn't know each other. They met on a thread, hence the name Threadheads. And one night over one too many cocktails, someone said they should have a little party, but it came out as Threadhead Pottery. And after the flood, one of them posted, "We can't just do this for fun anymore. We have to do something to help the musicians we love so much." So the Pottery became a fundraiser for the New Orleans Musicians Clinic initially, and then other music-related charities over the years. And in the 11 years since the flood, the Threadhead Pottery has donated over $600,000 to New Orleans music-related charities. At the second Pottery, I was doing an acoustic set with me and John Boutte, and a gentleman from Santa Monica, California, Chris Joseph, came up and said, "You guys are wonderful together. You should make a record." And I said, "Man, I lost my house and everything in it. I can't make rent." And he said, "Well, how much would you need?" And I gave him a figure. And he said, "Okay, I'll get back to you." And having been in the music business a long time, I said, "Yeah, right." But 2 weeks later, he called and he said, "Where do I send the check?" And I was stunned because he didn't say, "I need you to sign a contract." He didn't say, "I want to own the music." He didn't say anything about business. He said, "Just promise me on your word as a gentleman that when the record comes out, you'll pay us back the money, because some people that put up money could only afford to put up $5 because they've been out of work for 2 years, but they really wanted to help." And I was moved by that and promised I would. And we made a record for John Boutte, and then we made a record for me, and they were so energized because, you know, after the flood, we all felt so powerless. And if you weren't one of the people who could gut houses like Craig Klein's Araby Wrecking Crew went and gutted people's homes for them, I can't swing a hammer. I would just hurt myself or someone else. And suddenly there was a way that we all felt empowered, them as music fans and me as a musician. And they wanted to make another record. And I said, "Well, I've just made two and I'm tapped out." But Craig Klein's band ran out of money, and it would be the first brass band record since the flood. And, you know, I know this guy, Alex McMurray, you know, or whoever. I pointed them to friends until they didn't need me to point them anymore, until they got the picture that we're helping the musicians. And then they started finding themselves. And in the 11 years since the flood, they've raised another $600,000 that they've made over 53 CDs by New Orleans artists affected by the flood. So that's two things they've done that will change the face of Louisiana music for generations to come. In addition, they also started a Threadhead Foundation, which issues grants on a quarterly basis to not just musicians, but visual artists as well in New Orleans. And they also have an organization called Fest for Kids, where they make sure the kids get educated into the brass band music and get tickets to see Jazz Fest when it comes, so they can see the music and the culture that they're a part of and are being educated into. The Threadheads are one of the most incredible groups of people I ever met, had the good fortune to be associated with, and I think they're a great, great gift to the city of New Orleans.
Well, and you mentioned Jazz Fest, and so much comes out of Jazz Fest and the tie-in. And when you're talking about that, two things come to mind. Is that how you came to first get involved with Shamar Allen? Or how did you, what was the story there?
How did I meet Shamar? There was a guy in California named Stuart Blatt. He's a set designer for K-Ville. I don't know what show he's working on now. He never stops working. I called him the Cat in the Hat. Blatt the Cat in the Hat. And he and I became friends. He's a musician as well as a set designer. And he really loved the New Orleans music scene. And he turned me on to Shamar's song, "Meet Me on Frenchman Street," because every time we get together, he would sing it to me. I'd say, "You want to get together?" And he would sing, "Meet me on Frenchman Street." And so I hired Shamar for the first Rolling Road Show gig I did after the flood. And geez, I wish I could. I'll tell you how I met him. It just came back to me. Cowboy Mouth was doing an in-store appearance after the flood at Louisiana Music Factory, when it used to be across from the House of Blues, and Shamar's was still in the Hot 8 Brass Band, and they were playing after us, and I did Louisiana by Randy Newman on acoustic, and Shamar just stepped out of the crowd onto the stage in the middle of it and played a solo, and then he just stepped off the stage when he was done, and when the song was over, I said, "I don't know who that young man was, but that sure was beautiful," and he stepped back up to the mic, and with his dreadlocks hanging in his face, he said, "It's hard to play when you're crying." And he walked away, and I knew that he and I were going to be friends for a long time. That's how I met him, and that's how we began to work together.
Wow. Shamar Allen, as we're talking about, is just a phenomenal trumpet player.
Trumpet player, songwriter, producer, actor, really, he's a cultural ambassador to the United States State Department, teaching jazz around the world for President Obama. He teaches kids in his own neighborhood with his own foundation. He has money out of his own pocket. He buys instruments. His kids have gone on. Some of them have gone on to NOCA. Shamar also, in his travels for President Obama, went to Africa and was so moved, he started a program to try and get close to the African kids he met over there. The guy's all heart. He's all about love. He's an amazing young man. I'm glad to call him a friend.
Yeah, and when you were talking about Threadhead is what made me think about him, because when you see Shamar around town, you see him at Jazz Fest, there's always kids around him.
Yeah.
Right? Whether his own kids or somebody else's kids, or there's always kids around, and yeah, he's always trying to teach.
Yep.
And I saw that with you. I think the first time I saw Shamar was with you in Virginia, of all places, a little bitty club, and you were introducing him around, and he had that talent, but a little bit nervous, which you don't see too much from him today.
No, you don't see him nervous very often anymore. I'm glad you have a memory of him being nervous. I'll be sure to share that with him.
I remember walking up to him. He was just a little tentative. But it was great to see what's become of your partnership with him. But as you mentioned, all the things that Shamar has done. And that kind of gets back to my theme, Paul, that it feels to me like you've been just this wonderful connector throughout now, gosh, 30 years, maybe more, in New Orleans with musicians and I first met you in my parents' restaurant, and it's just part of that New Orleans thing, right? You shared experiences, and you figure out where the commonalities are, much like you and John Boutte. How did you first meet John?
John and I met at a backyard party in the French Quarter, and we were in our late 30s by the time we met, and we were kind of surprised that we hadn't even heard of each other, really, but I didn't listen to jazz much back then, and he had no interest in rock and roll. But we were sitting around jamming, as I do all the time, with the guitar, and he sang high and I sang low, and we were a nice fit. And we hit it off. We got to be friends. He's a very hilarious man. He's a very gracious fellow, charming. And he was kind of fascinated with my rock and roll lifestyle at the time, you know. Got him a gig with this True Experience thing down in Florida, and the whole band wanted to fly. I was going to be the only one on the tour bus, so I said, why don't you just come for a ride on the tour bus? And he loved riding on a tour bus, you know. So we just got to be friends and made some great music together. Our first song we wrote was called At the Foot of Canal Street. We weren't even planning on writing songs together. John really had only written one or two at that point. And we were walking down Canal Street by the end, by the cemeteries, and once again, just getting to know each other. And he pointed to a cemetery a couple blocks away and said, you know what, baby, my father's buried there. And I said, man, that's one more thing we got in common. My daddy's buried across the street. And he said, well, black or white, we all go meet at the foot of Canal Street. And so we went back and wrote that tune. And it led to us writing a bunch more together that I'm real proud of. And I love when he plays them live. It's his story to share with the world, his version of New Orleans that I got to help him shape.
Yeah, the foot of Canal Street is such a great story and such a great song. Because I think it's obviously not only about the two of you, but it could be about so many people in New Orleans, right?
Yeah.
You come across it, people say there's not 6 degrees of separation here, maybe a degree and a half. Right?
That's great.
And I love that story. But that reminds me, if you're ever in New Orleans, you want to check out Paul and some of the other people we're talking about. But a John Boutte show, if you get Songwriter of the Year, he has just this voice that captivating to me.
John's one of the greatest singers alive, and he can transport you to another place. And yes, do not miss him if you get a chance.
Definitely, certainly if you're in town for Jazz Fest, anything that he's doing. And of course, he won't be alone. Odds are you'll be with him or one of his many sisters. And that's one of the things that the Boutte family is a huge musical influence in the city.
Oh, yeah.
And over the years since you've met John, you've gotten to work with many of his sisters.
Yeah.
And
nieces.
And nieces, right. Mm-hmm. And that brings me to places, you know, if somebody was coming in and you were going to show them your New Orleans, where would you take them?
Well, I would take them to see John Boutte. I would pretty much insist on that, you know. I would take them to City Park. I love it there. I would take him to see Alex McMurray at Siberia because he's really at home there. I would take him to see Erica Falls anywhere because she's a musical goddess and must be seen. And then I would take them to eat. So many places I can't list right now. I would stuff them full of food until they complained that they needed naps, and then I would wake them up and I would feed them some more. If Teddy's was still open, I would be taking them to Teddy's for the best meatball po' boy in town. But Katrina took that option away, so now I have to go and explore on a daily basis to find the best.
That's right, and it's a Monday morning while we're recording this, and I was...
When I leave this interview, I'm going to go have a roast beef po' boy.
And I have a place in mind, actually. But I was driving over here with the windows down. It's a nice early October day, and I could smell red beans coming through.
It's Monday, right?
That's right.
You know it, baby.
And I thought, well, I don't see a restaurant. And then I realized it's probably not a restaurant.
Nope.
It's probably
somebody's house.
Somebody's house cooking red beans. You know, and so those collaborations, you mentioned Alex McMurray. And one of the things that certainly to me has come post-Katrina, at least as a fan and as a friend watching you, is those collaborations. You have the Rambling Road Show.
The Rolling Road Show.
Excuse me. And that seems to be a collection, slightly changing, but Alex McMurray and others in that.
Yeah, it's always an evolving membership. You know, it's who's available and who's rolling through my life at that time, musically and otherwise. I like to work with Alex a lot. He's a brilliant songwriter and truly one of the finest guitar players I ever had the pleasure of working with. And, you know, he's also occasionally even a friend.
And you mentioned two other former members of Cowboy Mouth, Sonia Tetlow and Mary Lessing.
I've worked with them as much as I could in the last 10 years. They're two of my favorite musicians I ever knew. I love them as people. In the last year, each of them went back to school and got a master's degree in public health and are now working full-time as social workers. So I don't have the opportunity to work with either of them as much as I used to, but I do when I can. I love them.
So tell me about one of the things that you spent a lot of time doing post-Katrina and really recently is going on the road solo. So you go out and you do home shows and other shows, right?
House concerts around the country as well as small venues. Yeah, those are great. I post on Facebook, does anybody want a house concert? And usually somebody does say yes. And then I'll post that date and say, I'm going here. Anybody else want something? And so far in the last year or so, it's worked out that people say yeah. And I wind up stringing together whole tours. Like I just got back from 3 weeks on the West Coast, from San Diego all the way up to Portland.
So how does a house concert work if somebody's interested in that? What's that look like?
It's pretty simple. I bring the sound and the guitar and the songs, and you gather your friends and family and loved ones, and you provide listening, smiling people, and I provide the music and the stories, and we talk about the money privately.
One of the things that I've enjoyed, I've gotten to go to a couple house shows. In fact, one when we were living up in Virginia with some folks that I didn't know that just had a shared interest and stayed connected with them a little bit. So that's one of the cool things. Sometimes, like you said, it's all people who know each other, and sometimes it's a gumbo a little bit.
You know, sometimes the hosts are really good when somebody sees it posted and says, oh, I live in that town, can I please come? And often because people are generous and music fans, I go, sure, you know, come out. And people do become friends, just like you did with that guy.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. I certainly think that if you listen to this and head to New Orleans either in the fall or you're coming for Jazz Fest, certainly to see Paul and see some of the others locally is a great thing. You know, I think about places like Chickawawa or Bufa's, you know, the kind of places that don't show up on lists necessarily.
Right. Right.
Coming off of Jazz Fest this year, we were stumbling down Esplanade like so many other people, and we looked up and said, oh, we're going to duck in this little place, Bufa's Lounge, which is well known here, but is not well known beyond.
Right,
and
right.
Stumbled into to you and Lynn Drury, and Alex McMurray joined you guys.
Yeah, it was a fun night.
And that's a typical kind of New Orleans thing. You know?
Yeah, I always tell people, you don't plan what to do in New Orleans. You just go out and New Orleans just happens. Happens all around you. I have a friend from New York, my buddy Michael Service. He's always talking about making plans when he gets here. I just said, just walk out your door, baby. It'll unfold, and I'll see you out there somewhere.
So that's my advice. You come in town, you come for Jazz Fest. You want to see some of the people we're talking about, but you just want to wander around and be loose with that and get to enjoy it. I do want to talk a little bit about Heart Renovations because, again, you bill it as a sequel, you know, a sequel to an album that's 2.5 decades ago. But it feels to me like there are some similarities and there's also some difference. Musically, it's different. But some of the stories are the same, right? And some of the stories are a little bit different. How do you describe
it? Of all the CDs I've made, that's Jet Black and Jealous has always been the one that people come up and say that's their favorite. And so I was curious as to why. And I went back and listened to it, and the songs were very simply presented. It was just me on acoustic guitar, no guitar solos, just strumming and singing. Songs are all very short as a result. It's story songs written in the rock tradition, essentially. And they're mostly sad because life's pretty hard and people can relate to sad songs. And I thought, well, I can do that. I can do all that stuff. And then the artist who did the artwork for Jet Black and Jellist, I asked him to do it for this one as well. And he pointed out that it also had a lyric sheet and that people could follow the stories and read the words. And that made a lot of sense. So it's a sequel thematically, stylistically, and musically. And it is a long time between sequels. But, you know, George Lucas takes a long time between sequels and nobody complains. So I figured I'm a fan of his. Maybe he'll be a fan of mine.
So I was looking at, I still have the liner notes from Jet Black and Jellist. I can't read them without reading glasses anymore.
That's the irony.
Which is sort of a thing. But in between, you know, so I mentioned 14 albums by yourself, I think, and numerous collaborations. And the thing that runs through those to me is there's so many about stories, right? Some of them about where you were in your life, where friends were in your life. Some of them are fun. Some of them were fun at the time and maybe a little less fun now. I think about Hurricane Party. Written, obviously, years before Katrina.
Right, yeah, when it was still fun.
Right, took on a different meaning. But that's the thing that strikes me, that whether you ever heard of Paul Sanchez or you haven't, I guess it's the gift of songwriting, right, and storytelling. There's something there for everybody.
I hope so. I try to make it so, you know.
I think you definitely succeeded. And I love In Heart Renovations. Again, it's an album about a difficult time and trying to find yourself and figure out what to do. But I love that the first song is I Still Believe. And that's very much a song about friendship. And, you know, it strikes me as raw and it's pretty right there in your face and a little bit harder driving than Jet Black and Jellist. But at the same time, when you peel that back, again, some of the people we've mentioned, Sonia and Mary and Ron.
Well, I hadn't had, when I made Jet Black and Jellist, I hadn't had a chance to play in Cowboy Mouth yet. So after playing Cowboy Mouth, I definitely rocked harder than I did before.
And I think I also read somewhere that in the last couple of years, you decided to take guitar lessons.
After the flood, really, you know, playing with Boutte, primarily, he's so generous, and his band members, Todd Duke and Herman LeBeau, were so, back then it was Leroy Jones, so generous to let me sit in. And I knew the jazz chords, but I knew them from guitar books, and I wasn't playing the proper voicings. And I never complained, but I could sense the music got a little tighter when I would sit in, even though they all smiled and were cool with me. So John Rankin came to see me speak at the Tennessee Williams Festival about songwriting, and afterwards he asked if I would give him songwriting lessons, and I said, would you trade and give me guitar lessons? And he said, great, and we became great friends as a result. And he taught me how to play the proper voicings to sit in with jazz guys. And when I went back to sit in with John, I pointed out that he had taught me the Freddie Green method, and when I played it with him, he just smiled and said, now, doesn't that sound better? And I said, yeah, but in my head, I thought, no, it still sounds like the same chords to me. But I understood that it sounded like the proper voicings to him, which made it more comfortable for him and his band. And that was a great lesson to learn. And John really opened up. I always could listen to different New Orleans musics, but he really opened up for me how to play them as a guitar player, especially rhythmically. Like, I was sitting in with my brass band friends. Back then, Shamar was still doing more brass band stuff. And Glenn David Andrews, of course, doing brass band stuff. And it all sounded like rock and roll to me. It's simple progressions, a lot of it, 1-4-5, but the rhythm, I was playing the wrong rhythm. My rock rhythms didn't fit, and I went to Rankin and explained that, and he explained in brass band music, it's all pretty covered by the horn, so you're sort of playing with the trumpet sections. It's a syncopated feel, and he showed me the space that fit in, and that really, again, explained to me how to make them feel comfortable having me sit in. And so he was a great guide. He taught me a lot about not just playing guitar, but music and how to make music with other fellas.
It's definitely obvious, but to me it was amazing. You'd had a long career, a successful career to that point, and then changed, and maybe that's part of the collaboration, the evolution. But you can definitely hear that to me a little bit. It's a little bit different on Heart Renovations. Tell me the story a little bit, if you could, about the Good Life song.
John Rankin, again, we became friends and have written a lot of songs together, and a lot of his song ideas just begin with an idea. Well, he'll say, I have an idea for a song, and I'll say, what? And he said, I thought growing old would take longer. And I said, well, that is a great idea for a song, my friend. And we we sat down and it was pretty easy. We're fans of the same songwriters, you know. That particular song, I think I had John Prine in mind, and we just traded lines. It's really easy to write with John. He's a musical encyclopedia. He knows way more. He's forgotten more about music than I will ever know. And he's a virtuoso on the guitar. So he can do anything. And I feel like the songs I've written with him, whether they're jazz tinged or folk tinged, are richer and more elegant than if I'd tackled either of those genres on my own, because he understands the voicings and the nuance of those styles as well as he does.
Do you talk about sort of wandering through New Orleans without a plan? And as you were talking about John, it hit me the other night. We had some friends in town. We took them to the Columns. We were in the back bar having a drink, and I heard some music coming. And we wandered up front. It was John Rankin.
Nice.
And I said, this is what New Orleans is about. We didn't plan this. We walk in here, and you just got exposed to one of the best evenings you could get.
Yep.
So that's, I love that song because, again, it may be telling the story of your life, but it could be anybody's life.
Well, that's the point of it, right? Yeah. If I did the good job telling the song, then you don't feel like you're listening to my life. You feel like somehow I eavesdrop on yours and turned it into a song. That's a good song.
And I've certainly felt that way through the years. You know, we talked about some of the sort of Jet Black and Jealous and Heart Renovations aren't necessarily the happiest songs, happiest albums. But in between, there was a whole lot of fun.
Sure.
You know, I think about Irish Boy, and I think about Evil Nasty Clown.
Well, getting drunk in Ireland on Heart Renovations.
Yes.
That's a lot of fun, you know. It's, that album's not all downer stuff, you know.
No, not at all. Not at all. I also like the little sort of, a Moose Boosh you dropped in the middle there, the quick little instrumental song, and I'm drawing a blank.
Rain in Acadia.
Yeah. It's beautiful.
Well, there was an instrumental on Jet Black and Jealous, so if it was going to be a true sequel, it needed an instrumental.
Yeah, that was a nice little surprise right in the middle there. Kind of going back just briefly, if we could, to some of the earlier songs. And what's the story of Evil Nasty Clown?
I had a friend who was from the Midwest and had come down and gotten a job as a bartender and got in over his head with bartender-related difficulties, extracurricular partying difficulties. He lost his girlfriend, he lost his apartment, he lost his job, and he was living with me in my place. I was single at the time and had a place where a friend could sleep if he needed to crash, which was my kitchen pantry, because it was empty except for a bottle of scotch and a jug of water and a can of cream corn in case I needed a base one night to drink on. So he would close the pantry door and sleep on the floor, and it was dark in there. He could sleep all day, and it was Mardi Gras. And he didn't have any money to buy a costume. And me and my buddies were going to Thrift City to buy costumes for ourselves. So we pitched in, got him an $8 clown costume. But $8 even in 1992 didn't buy a lot. It was ripped in the knees and the elbows where the linen underneath was, you know, showing through. And got him a wig for 50 cents, one of those clown wigs with the skull cap and the orange hair. But the skull cap had holes in it, you know, where the real hair was poking through. And the orange hair was hanging on by threads. And he hadn't shaved in a few days, and he'd been drinking for a few days. And when he got the whole outfit on, he was a pretty scary-looking clown. So we gave him a cane full of paper flowers, thinking that if he had the cane full of paper flowers to give out flowers for kisses, you know, how they do in Mardi Gras, that he would look less threatening. But he just held the cane above his head, and it looked more intimidating than he had before. And a little girl came up somewhere on St. Charles Avenue and said, "Hey, mister, can I have a flower?" And he said, "No!" And the mom said, "Come away, honey. He's a bad clown." And then a nun walked up and said, "Can I have a flower for a kiss?" And he said, "No, sister, I'm giving out spankings for flowers." And she said, "But this isn't a costume. I'm a real nun." And he said, "No, I'm going to give you a real spanking." And it being Mardi Gras and, you know, this being New Orleans, I'm not making it up. The nun bent over and took the spanking and got the flower, and that officially made him a nasty, evil clown.
What a great story. What a great story. Well, Paul, I just want to thank you so much for doing this.
It's my pleasure, man. Good to see you.
It's good to see you. It's good to share you with people who maybe don't know who you are. And if they do know who you are, then they get a little bit more taste. You know, you can check out Paul again over at paulsanchez.com. You can find him on Facebook. Wherever you are in the country, you could pick up Heart Renovations, Jet Black and Jealous. But try to find a house concert or host one yourself. And hopefully you'll see him on the road one of these days. Thanks again, my friend.
Thank you, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for listening, y'all. And again, a thanks to Paul Sanchez. You can find the notes for today's show on our website over at beyondbourbonst.com/23. And you can find Paul at paulsanchez.com, on Instagram at paulsanchezmusic, and on Facebook. You can find Paul's music on iTunes as well. If you want to get an actual CD with the liner notes, try Louisiana Music Factory or Amazon. Better yet, host a home show. As Paul mentioned during the interview, the best way to find out about his shows is to follow him on Facebook. Thanks so much for listening, y'all. And a special thanks, of course, to Paul Sanchez for joining me on the podcast. I hope you got a taste of what a wonderful storyteller Paul is. Spending an evening at one of his shows is a great way to immerse yourself in New Orleans culture. If you want to hear more shows like this one, please subscribe on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play Music. If you have an idea for a future episode, or you just want to reach out to me, my email is mark@beyondbourbonst.com. We love doing the show and hope you love it too. If you do, please tell others about Beyond Bourbon Street. New episodes are available every other Wednesday. We're working on future stories about the HBO series Tremé, A Girl's Guide to the Crescent City, plus many more. Until next time, laissez le bon temps rouler.
Thanks for listening to the Beyond Bourbon Street podcast. Find us anytime at beyondbourbonst.com.